Welcome to the No Direction Podcast, PaizoCon 2017 seminar coverage. Remember, we con when you can't.
That's not fair.
We're cruel and arbitrary.
Like GMs.
Yeah, we're not here to be fair. We're here to hurt you. So, welcome to Ask the Paizo GMs. Well, I guess we can just go ahead and get started.
Might as well.
Let's get introductions.
It's the last panel of the show. We can bend the rules a little and start a minute early.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to Arbitrarily Cruel, the Ask the Paizo GMs panel. I'm Crystal Frazier, and I guess I'm moderating?
Okay.
You are now.
Son of a... I'm one of the developers on the Pathfinder AP line. You can see my work in Iron Fang Invasion, and before that, in a variety of modules and player companions, and... God, what else have I developed?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. Pretty much.
A rash.
Pretty much everything, yeah.
And as Crystal... kindly illustrate. Sometimes GMing is about passion, saying I want to do it, and sometimes it's about a bunch of gamers sitting around sheepishly until somebody says, okay, I guess I'm the one doing this then. Hi, I'm John Compton. I'm the Organized Play lead developer, so I do Pathfinder Society and soon-to-be Starfinder Society. And that is primarily what I work on, though I do a lot of writing, including a bunch of AP volumes coming up.
Where's my turnover, John?
First I owe you an outline.
Where's my outline, John?
Start writing it now.
You can beat it out of my knees.
Hi, I'm Jason Bowman. I'm the lead designer at Paizo. I run the rules team, who's responsible for the majority of our giant, heavy hardcover books that we make you carry around at shows like this. So, although now they come in softer pocket sizes, so that's nice.
So pillow-esque.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, now you can... just load those up. So, yeah, that's me.
And they're printed on Earth-friendly granola.
I would love to see that on the back.
Do not eat your core rule book.
No, eat your core rule book. Why?
Buy another. Second.
Well, yeah. That's fair. Yeah, the rules in there are not very nutritious.
Just put a little line that says, but it will provide you enough fiber.
No. So, yeah, so this is a Q&A, so...
This is Ask the GM, so this really is on you. So we're just going to literally point at you and then help solve your GM
Goblin problem. Squad, what you got for us?
All right, so first a statement, then a question. Statement is, so normally when there's a trap, you have to do a search action and then find it, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, the actual question is, in the, I think, Advanced Player's Guide, there's a feat called a quick trap or something like that that lets you, with a full round action, lay down a trap. Do the opponents in combat actually have to make a spot check of some kind to see that, or since you did it out in the open, they just see it?
Are you thinking of the Trapper Ranger archetype from Ultimate Magic?
Definitely not.
Yeah, there's another Trapper Rogue archetype in, I want to say, Advanced Player's Guide or Ultimate Combat?
Yeah.
But yeah, I've always interpreted that particular class ability as like I pull a bear trap out of my pack and I throw it into that square. So
I treat it a bit like I would spell casting. Like if you're doing a glyph of warding, well, there's a perception check to find a glyph of warding. But if you're going to sit there and cast a spell and be like da 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 bam, and make a little thing on the ground as everybody's watching you. Okay, it's like trying to hide while observed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
there's no way that you don't stop and fuddle with all this stuff in a square, like
don't look at me,
and not have the opponents go, he put something there. I'm not going in that square, right? I mean, that just falls into the realm of like.
Well, yeah, that seems very sensible. I was just getting caught up that you always have to make a perception to see a trap, and this isn't making a lot.
Well, no, you have to make a perception check to see a trap that is in place. This is someone taking an action.
Okay.
Yeah.
Right. So, I mean, and that goes for almost anything. That's the problem we always have with spellcasters, right? That people are like, oh, well, if it doesn't have a somatic and it doesn't have a verbal, do you see me do anything at all? And our general answer has to be, yeah, you at least concentrate, sweat rolls down your forehead, you do something. You may not have the components, but just because you remove some of them doesn't mean the spellcasting is now invisible. We actually wrote rules for that in Intrigue, just so that if you did want to be like, I'm going to throw a spell at you and I don't want you to know that I did it, we actually built that, and I think it's based off bluff, and there's some feats that allow you to do it. I think, you know, characters are always kind of looking for an edge, and that's their job, right?
Yep.
You know, the job of the player characters is to find a way to kind of be the best and get their, pull off their tricks and their maneuvers.
Yeah, but I mean, if you don't have the time to like pull some leaves over your trap, then it's just a big set of steel jaws sitting on the ground there waiting for somebody to step into it.
With five tripwires.
Yes, and somebody might stumble into it over the course of combat, but if it's just sitting out there and everybody saw you lay it out and snap it open, then it's not really subtle what it is. I mean, if you've got a minute or so to like brush some leaves over it when nobody's looking, then obviously there's a perception check for it, but
yeah.
A lot of it is just kind of falling back on common sense and like what's realistic in the scenario. I mean, the reason we do tabletop games instead of computer games is because we can educate a lot more scenarios just based on what makes sense if we were there. You had your hand up right before him.
So I am putting together a group of my regular group is now in our off hours doing basically 1 to 11 in society.
Okay.
Are there any good ways that I could modify, like introductions or something, to string a story together for the four of them, given that they're going to be playing consistent characters?
So, so to make sure I understand, you're taking Pathfinder Society scenarios, you are taking ones from all over the course of seasons,
yes,
to create your own story arc.
Sort of, but I'm trying to do it within the context of society to give them boons and chronicle sheets and all of that as well.
Okay. Typically,
we had that training scenario.
We do. We have a bunch of evergreen ones that allow you to get introduced to things. So, is the question like, which ones should I choose?
No, the question is like how, within the context of the Pathfinder Society organized play program, would I be allowed to
expand
the scenarios?
For the organized play program, adding in a little bit of extra flavor so long as it's not like changing the nature of the adventure or anything like that, that's fine. Like, for example, we do a lot of sanctioning of modules and adventure paths,
mm-hmm,
many of which do not assume that you're Pathfinders.
Yeah.
So it's totally fine to like write up your own little venture captain briefing and be like, oh, by the way, the reason that we are doing Feast of Ravenmoor is Pathfinder Society explanation.
Okay.
Please go do module, says the venture captain. So yeah, that's fine.
Okay, cool. And then I have one more for when other people have gone.
Okay. Right here.
I have taught my current group how to play, and there's still one particularly shy player. I know I can't necessarily force her to role play, but she is making a bit of an effort, and it feels almost like she's looking to me to give her just that kind of push over the edge. Do you have any suggestions for that?
Generally, I mean, make sure that's what she's looking for. I mean, a lot of players are just more shy or more reserved and don't want to be the center of attention, so I mean, make sure that she wants the little shove more into the spotlight or into more attention. But aside from that, talking with her away from the table to find out like what kind of character hooks she wants to latch onto or what scenarios she would be comfortable or be excited about seeing in the game would help a lot.
One thing that I tend to keep in mind is that NPCs don't necessarily have to talk to the group. They will oftentimes talk to individuals. And so if an NPC has a reason to prefer one of the group members, such as this person's character, over the others, then it, and this works really well for when you have like a really pushy, aggressive player too, or a spotlight hog, just to be like, no, I don't care what you have to say. I want to know what your side of the story is.
You could have a really introverted NPC who just like,
who freaks out every time.
Yeah, when somebody gets too confrontational.
Please stop. Like, I don't want to talk for more than 2 minutes. You seem like you are also have a like soft voice. Can we just like find a corner and talk away from people? that kind of. I want one of those in a scenario now. Where it's like, your diplomacy modifier is too high. Please go away.
That's Scone it, Taldor.
Yeah, I always tend to look for, you know, whenever I've got, you know, whenever I'm running a show at a convention or whatnot, you always have a few folks at the table who are a little bit more reserved than the rest. You get some boisterous folks, some shire folks. I'm always kind of looking for, like, as a GM, I'm always looking to play with what the players give me, right? So if they give me a tiny hook, I'll play with the tiny hook, right? You know, they mention, they drop that they've got a, you know, a sister that lives in town. That, you know, all of a sudden, that's the person that has the next problem that they have to deal with. Giving them something that ties back into the story that they're giving you is a way to not only make them feel like they are contributing to the story in a way that's more than just, I do this, I say this. Their story has now become part of the story. So yeah, I mean, I think that's always a smart play, whether or not you're dealing with a shy character or not, to be honest. But that's always a good way to get people to kind of engage because it's something that they initiated, they started, right? You know, a family member, a magic item, a weird quirk, you know, they like a certain food dish, and now all of a sudden, you know, like, oh, they really like pork belly, and all the pigs in town are gone, right? You know, and all of a sudden their thing is an issue, and they can at least role play off of it if they want, so... That was a terrible example. Anyway.
I don't know. So, that yeah, happened to Alyssa like 2 weeks ago.
Yeah. I actually went to the Thai place last night and had the pork belly. Anyway. I was on my mind. that's the way it works. All right.
Anybody else? Generally, I've run somewhat low magic campaigns, anywhere from like arcane and divine spellcasters get, they have to make spellcraft checks, otherwise they get the bare minimum of the effect, to just ones where it's not a lot of magic. Mm-hmm. But I decided to run one because they were pressuring me to, where it's just play whatever you want, have all sorts of like freedom to it, and it's starting at 10th level. Mm-hmm. And there's a whole bunch of crazy characters, because like they finished entire APs, so before, so mm-hmm. I don't think 10th level is a bad place to start. And there's all sorts of crazy characters. There's the one who wanted to have split personality disorder and have one side worship Clustria and one side worship Shelm. But then one of the characters found out that 10th level characters have a lot of money to start with, and they found out how cheap a cat was. So they're trying to start out their character with 10,000 cats. Because you can do that.
Well, first of all,
get a bag of holding.
No, but like,
first of all, you can't herd cats. So
what? We've tried.
Yeah, you can't herd cats. Speaking as a game developer, that's, I mean, just economy of scale. People can't buy that many cats in a small scale economy. I mean, if you think it's disruptive or just plain silly or is going to take away from the game, you're well within your power as the GM. Rule number one is always, like, you're there to make sure everything runs smoothly and, I mean, make sure everybody has a good time, but make sure nobody's kind of ruining the scenario by bringing 10,000 cats.
And if 10,000 cats is the goal, let them buy 10, and then every time they progress the plot line, they find somebody else who just has another litter to adopt.
Yeah, I mean...
It's like a video game where you have to get all the collectibles, and it's you missed two cats in that dungeon.
And now, of course, there's the pawnbroker outside of town who will sell each one that you missed for 1,000 gold pieces.
Yeah, it's fine. If you want 10,000 cats, that's the only way you're going to pull this off.
Make it
that's the only way you unlock the super dungeon.
And remember, pet food is 1 copper per day per animal.
Oh. Yeah, but if you put it all out, one cat will eat like 4 cats. And then you end up with a really fat cat, and ends up with the giant template, and then it just becomes a problem.
Who horked in my bag of holding? That's supposed to be there. It's a spell component pouch.
Whiskers!
You also remember a bag of holding doesn't have its own oxygen supply. I've run into this with several players before. They put live things in the bag of holding.
I don't think that was the plan. I think the plan was to just have... I think they wanted to be... I think they also wanted to be a animal lord with like the cat things.
Oh, I was really hoping this was a wizard, so it was like a crazy cat wizard.
Because he wanted to direct his army of expendable cats at the enemies.
Okay. This changes some things.
Yeah,
okay.
That changes the scenario.
So, we have alignment consideration.
Yeah, because once you have, anybody who starts using animals in an expendable fashion in a campaign setting in which there are druids is inviting trouble, especially if that person isn't the is an animal lord, because there's the implication of Bestiary 3 that each animal lord, or that there's only one animal lord for each animal type. So if this is the cat lord, then you might have like druids with assassin prestige class levels coming after this person with the knowledge that if we kill this cat lord, we can get one that's actually responsible.
And you can save 10,000 cats.
I know.
Very important.
So, unless you have like a grand plotline already in place, if they're just like, I want to have 10,000 cats so I can use them as cannon fodder, then turn that into the plotline.
Did you say cannon fodder?
I am now.
Okay.
Hey, we're talking adventures here. So,
it's all part and parcel. It's the whole kit and caboodle.
Alright. So, you're... on a slightly more serious note.
What?
just for a second, I swear. After this, we can get back to cat jokes. Your setup kind of exposes a problem with the game when you start with 10th level characters. A 10th level character, typically the game kind of assumes that they're built organically, right? You know, the character that has 10,000 cats didn't start with 10,000 cats, right? As a first level character, they can't afford 10,000 cats. It's very expensive. I mean, they're not that expensive, but it's expensive enough that you can't have 10,000 of them. So over their adventuring career, they'd have to build up cats. Now, that means that as they do so, they would run into all the problems as the number got bigger and bigger and bigger. This really applies more to, like, magic items and stuff. If you build a 10th level character and use all of their wealth to buy just the right items, your character will be significantly more powerful than a character that started at first level and made their way to 10th, getting items organically.
Yeah.
Right? So, as a GM, you got to be a little careful when you start a campaign at a higher level. Because, first of all, you're going to get characters that have crazy concepts because they didn't have to suffer through the levels where their concept didn't work yet. Right? It's like if you wanted to play, you know, if you want to play a...
Mystic Theurge.
A Mystic Theurge. Yeah, you have to spend a number of levels being kind of a bad character, right? And not having all of your powers sync up before you hit those Mystic Thurge levels and then become really quite good. You're allowing them to skip all those parts where they would have had to pay the price for their crazy decisions. So you have to be a little cognizant of that. I like when I start groups at higher levels, I'm like, okay, you're going to get half the wealth to spend on whatever you want. I'm going to take the other half the wealth, pool it all up from the entire rest of the party, and I'm going to roll randomly on a big pile of magic items that you guys own and can split up however you want. That way, some of their items are organic, and they're not all pre-chosen. And it's just a big pile. They can take whatever they want, and if they don't like the things in it, they can sell them for half price and start with less maximum wealth, but that's their call.
Yeah. Also, keep in mind, cats do, like, I want to say a D3 minus 3 damage. Yeah. Anything with DR, and their cats are gone.
Well, top it off, most of the time they're going to be dealing non-lethal, so...
Plus, you know. I mean, cats? Have you ever tried to get a cat interested in doing anything?
No. Your entire adventure is going to be sitting there in your room with 10,000 cats
and
they lick themselves. You're like, can we go now? And they're like, no.
Anytime he wants to direct his animals, that's 10,000 handle animal checks.
I just think one of the lines, you know, at 10th level, a fireball is going to be...
Oh.
Fluffy, no! Fluffy 1 through 48, no!
Crispy critters.
Alright, another question then.
Does this question involve 10,000 cats?
Does this say...
Or just make them individually name all of them?
It's 10,000. So in all your guys' years of writing and running a game, what would you say is like the most like... act like the thing that GMs use to kill players either by accident, like that you didn't expect would be a problem.
Times I have accidentally killed characters. I don't know that that's a thing.
Barroom brawls.
Like things that you didn't expect to kill
characters. Like, well, random fights the PCs start with townsfolk have killed both characters and campaigns because, like, I'm a 5th-level adventurer. This is a bunch of 1st-level commoners. I'm just going to shove them around to get what I want and take things. And, like, all right, they call the guards. It's like, the guards are a bunch of first and second level warriors. I'm a fifth level character. Like, there's 20 of them. Like, I'm still going to fight them.
Yeah.
And then you have to kill the party's wizard, and then everybody's pissed at you, and then the campaign ends.
Yeah, escalation definitely is one of those. For me, the most unexpected character deaths have been a result of characters finding something like on a pre-printed map and asking me if it's there, and then going to explore it. I can do some story time. So Frost for Captives uses Flipmat Mountain Pass, which has like a 10-foot wide bird nest with a giant egg in it. And we decided that we were going to run for Pathfinder Society, we were doing it at a bar, that we were going to run Bard Night, where every person had to play a bard at all four of the tables. And so the group I was running had this halfling who was just like, I'm Malkar the Magnificent, meh! And he saw this bird nest while all the rest of the party was fighting, and he's like, is that thing actually there? I'm like, sure, why not? It's there. And so he had like a grappling hook whip and was like able to climb his way up there, found it, he's like, oh, there's a huge egg, I want this thing, says the halfling. Like, I don't even know what to do with you right now, but make a perception check. He does. He sees the shadow pass over him. Mommy's home. So I expect this just to scare him back down to the rest of the group. No. Bullshit. He basically pulls out a short sword, punches a hole in the egg, and tries to climb inside. Mommy comes down and sees that there's an egg shaking as the halfling fails his escape artist check to actually get inside the egg. Succeeds only quickly enough to make a stealth check to hide behind the little chick inside. Oh. Mommy sees the egg starting to fracture and decides to help it hatch, at which point the halfling freaks out, punches a hole in the other side, fails another escape artist check to try and wriggle out, and basically falls down the cliff, lands in a bank of snow, and is at zero hit points and staggers back to the party covered in yolk and being like, hey guys, I've defeated a rock! And they're like, what the hell's wrong with you? What are you covered in? They get to the next town, which is full of all these Ulfins who hate the local witches called Judwiga, and he decides that he's going to go inside and try and find some, like, recruit some help. Which, his idea of doing that is to walk up to some really burly people in a bar and be like, hey guys, and like, what the hell's wrong with you? And like, I defeated a rock. Was it like a stone on the ground? No, it was like a giant bird. What is covered in you? Like, look, we're not going to deal with you. And they start to turn away. He's like, I won't deal with this. I'm Melkor the Magnificent. Hypnotism. To which they all fail. To which they all succeeded their will saves. Stand up and say, are you Judwiga? And he's like, I don't know what that term is, but it seems important. Yes. All of the bar stands up, draws axes. He's like, I'm sorry, was I Judwiga? No, my friend is Judwiga. And he's just like, I'm not in this. And so at that point, like, I couldn't kill him the first time because it was an encounter that had just, like, it was not part of the scenario at all. This time he was just picking a fight. And they eventually found him in an alley when he was like, can I hide in this alley? He's like, well, there's a missing brick. He's like, I tried to shove myself in there. And then they never heard from him again. So, like, unexpected things where people are like, is this actually a thing? Can I interact with it? Can I cause trouble with this? Then
so,
yes.
So he really...
He was out.
He really had egg on his face.
Can we go back to cats?
So anyway, I think the running theme here is the most common cause of unexpected player death is players.
Yeah, pretty much.
Well, and it's oftentimes either player boredom or player curiosity that's just like, I mean, I killed Mona in one of my games because they're looking into this room that is obviously filled with a horrible trap. It clearly has a nightmarish trap in it, and Mona can't, the group can't figure it out. And Eric's getting bored, and it's just like, fine, I just try and jump it. And I'm like, you fired an arrow through it, and it got blown down through the floor and disappeared, and you're going to try and jump through? Okay. So he jumped through the wind wall that then blew him down through the illusionary floor, down into the pit.
So how many times has Ostug been slain?
No, well, this was in the daily grind, that dungeon I have on the wall of my office.
Yeah,
he still hasn't forgiven me for that, and it was his fault. And I'm just like, well, I didn't... You knew it was a trap. Like, it was obvious. I didn't even ask you to make a check. It was clearly a trap. He was like, well, but I didn't think it would kill me.
Oh my God. if we're telling crazy player stories,
I get to put one in.
All right, so giant, evil, cursed castle perched atop a precarious cliff on a dark and stormy night. Players are exploring it. It is clearly haunted. The guy who owns it is obviously an evil vampire wizard. They find a locked chamber in a secret room with a box on a pedestal. And once they enter the room, everybody has to make will saves. They all succeed, and I say, okay, you feel a brief urge to open the box, but you fight it off.
Oh, God.
And one of my players looks at me and says, but I can still open the box, right?
What's in the box?
John Doe has the upper hand.
Next question.
Yes, next question. Oh,
I love
Goblin
Squad. So what have been the most effective things you guys have found for preventing your players from engaging in what's called non-productive activities?
Oh, God, if we knew that, we'd have a lot more money.
Just useless endeavor to even try.
So like, preventing derailing?
Yeah, derailing. Picking fights with old phones, going in grass or rocks, deciding that they're going to try and farm 10,000 cats. The stuff which is clearly not progressing the story.
The next fight, or the next plot hook, is always a stupid fight away. So if they're going to pick a fight with old man Jenkins down the street, even though they're supposed to go and slay a dragon, great. Old man Jenkins has some sort of, like, will that says that, oh, yes, whoever holds this sure doesn't inherit this really cool magic item that is only in the dragon's hoard, or what have you. So whatever it is, you can use that to steer them in the direction, even if they're being, you know, larcenous, murderous jackals in the meantime.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, ultimately as GM, your job is kind of, you know, the improv maestro, right? It's like your job has to be yes and, right? Okay, you want to do that. Okay, you can do that. But the trick is letting them do it in a way that then leads them right to where you planned on them going anyway, just throwing out the hook you had. I'm always a very big fan of being like, here's my planned plot line. I don't really care how you interact with it. I will, if you come to a fork in the road and left is the way I need you to go, that's what the map says, left is towards the adventure, the group will invariably decide to go right.
Or up.
Yeah.
Or back.
Or backward, or they'll start digging into the ground. I don't know. They'll do something. But the trick is, it doesn't really matter which direction they pick. Whatever direction they pick is left. They may call it right. That's fine. It doesn't matter. It's left. Right? You have to balance that, right? I mean, you know, if they are aware of the direction that they need to go, and then they go a different direction and it ends up being, then you're railroading them, right? But the trick there is kind of, you know, to get them to go where you've put your effort. Get them to do the thing that you have planned to do, but still giving them the freedom to do it in the way that they want to do it, right? So sometimes that means they try and buy 10,000 cats.
Yeah. Sometimes it's just an issue of making it personal.
Yeah.
Like, maybe they don't want to slay the dragon, but the second the dragon basically drops out of the sky, uses flyby attack to snap something shiny from them and then fly off.
Like a cat.
Then suddenly it's personal. One of my favorite stories ever was a podcaster who talked about, he had this campaign where, like, just to be a dick, he had the low-level characters fight a dragon, and most of the dragon's hoard was copper pieces. So they said, fuck it, we'll go back to town, we'll buy a cart. They brought the cart back, just shoveled it full of copper pieces, which ended up being about the cost of the cart. Brought it back to town, and while they were in the tavern drinking, somebody stole their cart full of copper pieces. Worth
double
like
the money.
150 copper, or 150 gold. And they spent the next 5 levels tracking down their cart full of 150 copper pieces.
And it'd be even better because, like, every time they find a different clue, it's like, oh yeah, this is where a guy came in, and he was loaded with money. He dropped 50 copper and bought everybody in the bar beers. It's like, that's 50 more we're going to beat out of him.
Yeah. But the point is, if you do something that affects the players personally, then suddenly they have a reason, they have a motivation. It is no longer just telling a story, it is about them beating you.
To expand on that, I always like to make the players kind of responsible for what's going on in some way, shape, or form. It's a good trick you can pull off. You can't do it all the time, but when you can do it, it's delightful, right? You know, it's like, I had an entire campaign start off, innocuous adventure, young adventurers going on a simple quest. It wasn't even the plot line of the campaign. It was just the starter adventure to give them a chance to adventure together in something that was low stress. And on the way there, they get to a crossroads. And at the crossroads, the traveling magistrate, right, you know, these towns are really small. They don't have their own judge. So the magistrate travels around and hands out justice. And he apparently had found some rustler, some cattle rustler, and they had put him in the crow cage at the crossroads. And poor guy's just sitting in this crow cage. He can't get out. He's probably going to starve to death. And he's begging them for water and food. And they're good, new, fresh-faced heroes. So they give him water and food. They don't let him out, but they give him water and food. Then they go on their adventure. They go and do their stuff. They you know, do all their things. And then they get back. And when they're coming back, he's not in the crow cage anymore. He got out. Somebody let him out, but they certainly gave him food and water that allowed him to survive. He ended up being the major villain of the entire campaign. He was a warlord that ended up summoning all these armies, and it was all this crazy shit. And when they finally realized what was going on, they were like, oh my god, we're partially responsible for this guy making it. He was horrible. He was in there for a reason. Our compassion let him live, right? You know, so
never again.
Yeah, and why, that same group, the next time, they were like, yeah, you ever try pulling that on us again, we're just killing whoever's in the crow cage. That's what we're doing next time. Yeah.
No. The best part is when you take their, like, their sideways antics and turn that into what unleashes the major villain. Like,
oh, sure.
This party became obsessed. Like, I went through this phase in my early 20s where I really liked giving every magic item, like, its own name and slight history, which backfired because they decided, well, like, we found this named necklace, and it was, I want to say, like, a periapt of health. So, a good item, but not an artifact. But I mentioned it's, like, from the court sorcerer of X and X. So-and-so long ago, and they're like, well, we want to find out, because obviously this was a court sorcerer who could make magic items, and, like, I bet they're buried with a bunch of it. So they derail the whole campaign over this necklace to go to the capital city, and then they break into the royal archives, beat up a bunch of monks who guard the archives, and sneak down into, like, the old historic records section and start just randomly going through books looking for references.
Please tell me this ends with grave robbery.
I'm hoping it ends with them finding that he was buried with a comb.
Nope. I was planning on having a, like, ancient evil dragon spirit unleashed by a cult later on. Mm-hmm. So I just basically, instead of the dragon spirit being captured in a gem that the cult was going to steal at the adventure site they were supposed to be going to, I'm just like, fuck it, the dragon was sealed in one of these hidden books that they're, like, rifling through to find treasure. So they open one, and there's a flash of blue light, and nothing happens, and the book's not magical anymore, and they don't know what's going on, and then they find out their favorite barmaid is acting weird and murdering people.
Let's get some more questions.
Okay.
So I'm usually our group's GM, as you may have picked up on, but due to the fact that I'm doing more classes at college right now, I had to step onto the other side of the screen, and one of my regular players stepped up and said, you know what, I'm going to run Reign of Winter. And I'm like, that's fantastic! And it's not going very well. We typically clear an AP, like a single volume, in 4 sessions. Four longer sessions, 8 hours each. We're on session 5 or session 6, and we just finished the sanctioned portion of Reign of Winter Book 1, which is about 8 hours of gameplay over the course of 6 sessions, which are sitting down for 8 hours, but there's only about 3 hours of play. And that is incredibly frustrating to me. Any ways I can try and...
There are lots of different things that could be extending this. Is it that the person is really slow on calculations? Is it that the players are derailing? Is that you're doing a lot of really fun role-playing and everybody's having fun? Is it that there's so much more table talk than there normally is? There are lots of different things that could be happening.
Yeah, is it just taking longer to reference?
It's a little bit of table talk. It's a little bit of one of the players is relatively inexperienced and is playing a really weird blend of an APG summoner using the Unchained Summoner spell list. So that's kind of weird in and of itself. There's the fact that the GM isn't that skilled, is still relatively new.
I think, first off, it's kind of strange that a completely new GM has decided to take on an entire AP all at once. I mean, that can be done. Mm-hmm. It can turn out very nicely, but it's also a really imposing challenge. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I'm going to say, I was going to add that some of these problems will just even out with time. The more comfortable your player gets behind the screen, the better they get to know the layout of the rule book, the faster they'll be able to reference things. The more they get to know the monsters, then the faster it'll be, or combat will go. And, I mean, you sounds like you've been running for years and years and years, so...
Ish. Two.
Sure.
Running... Okay. But at this point, you've gone through a few APs, and like you said, you can get through them pretty fast, and a lot of this is just developing the skill set that you've been practicing for 2 years.
Yeah, patience.
Yeah. Patience, and I mean, one thing that helps me a lot is I'm terrible at remembering the rules, so I like to have a rules caddy out of one of my players to just like, by the way, you're sickened. Could somebody look up the sickened rules for me?
Yeah,
or,
that's me.
Or hey, yeah. Could somebody, or you're deputized to track initiative always.
Yeah.
Well, you can also play the role, and I've done this in games, where I try and help the GM by being the plot facilitator, right? Which is I know where this is going. You know, there's this weird guy in the bar, and that's how this adventure is starting, and the group is all like, I'm going to go look at the menu, and I'm going to order things. I end up being the player that's like, I go talk to the weird guy, right? You know, because I know that's where the adventure is. And that helps get things moving and get things going, right? You can drag the other characters along with you, kind of kicking and screaming if you have to.
The sort of moment where everybody's talking, you're just like, I open the door.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, yeah.
No, we haven't guessed our spells yet. Too late.
Yeah, no, too late.
I have that player.
Throg is born. Throg open door.
Doors are the unholy abomination.
Right. Yeah, my...
You know, of course,
door slain.
Of course, that went fantastically until we were up in the boss fight, right before the portal that takes you into Irisin. And I say to the GM on the side, hey, where's the troll? And they were like, well, you know, I wasn't going to throw it at you, because you're really freaking hurt, but okay.
Well, yeah, keep things moving.
Yeah.
by plot advancement or death, it's going forward. Yeah. Or
did you say something?
Yeah, my old GM, when I started working at Pizer, was like, well, now I can't run you in any APs, because you're going to know them all. And like, well, I'll just... play an oracle who knows or who sees hints of what's coming anyway and just keep the plot on track.
Yeah.
He's like, you're going to use it to cheat? No.
Guys probably dealt with varying variations of it, but in regards to when characters give you, like, you know, they write up a background for the character for either a new campaign or they just have someone die and now they're bringing in a replacement. Do you prefer it when they become as detailed as they are, you know, like maybe when someone turns in, like, you know, a 3-page backstory for their character, or just so you have so much to work with for their character, or do you find it as frustrating when it's the person that, like, dots down 3 possibly complete sentences and that's their background?
Every player's different,
yeah,
and that's fine.
I usually like to start a lot of my campaigns off with, like, a questionnaire. That way I'm kind of engaging with them to be like, hey, this, you know, this campaign is starting in this town. You know this character. Here's a little bit about him. What's your relationship to him? Right? You know, you're friends with one of these 5, you know, clergy members in town. Pick one and tell me the nature of your friendship. Why are you friends with this person? right? Giving them some pointed, like, yeah, you can tell me more about your family, right? One of the questions might be, what kind of family do you have in town? You know, see, none is an answer, right? But that way, I'm getting kind of a bit more of a uniform response from the group, and just be like, hey, you don't have to give me a million pieces of information here, but any information you give me is something that's going to help me build a story that's more about you, right? I mean, I think one of the biggest challenges with many adventures is that the adventure is a story and it is telling itself, but it's not really about the characters necessarily. Mm-hmm. That's the GM's job to make it about the characters, but the characters have to give you something to engage with, right? So yeah, that's my tip.
Also gives you plot points too.
Yeah, so. Yeah, exactly.
Oh, right here?
So this happens more in society, but just due to the nature of it. But so when you have a table that's made up of players with different sort of play styles of combat heavy, RP heavy, or even just different levels of system mastery, like say they both really like combat, but one guy's definitely better at it, what do you do to make sure that all your players are having a good time at that table?
Sure, the spotlight is one of them. A lot of scenarios, not all of them, have a couple different encounters of different types. So if there is that role-playing diva at your table who's just going to be like, I want to talk to them, or I want to be able to talk down every encounter, like, okay, there's going to be that moment for them to really shine. And for, not for everybody, but for some people, it's, as long as I have that moment in the adventure where I get to be in the spotlight and be awesome, I can take a backseat for the rest of it. So that's one thing. When it comes to people of different levels of system mastery, especially if the person who has more system mastery is like more aggressive in that regard, it's like, you need to flank with me, and then make sure you do this thing, and get to high ground for this, like the little Napoleon at the table. You as a GM like can step in. Like, you are there also as a social arbiter to say, okay, I know that you have strong feelings about this, but this is this person's character. And you can help say, like, okay, I want to know what you want to do, or even sometimes for those with lower system mastery, not asking them what mechanically they want to do, but what is it you want to accomplish? And then they say, oh, I want to do this thing, and you can say, okay, well, by the rules, here's some ways you might be able to accomplish it. Which of those appeal to you? So control the interactions between your players, and then give everybody a little bit of a chance to shine.
And I think a big part of that, too, is just being like, okay, so, you know, you're the character who, you know some of the rules, but you don't have them all down. So with those characters, I'll be like, so, yeah, you know, you could do this, you could do that. But the guy who's got mastery, who I can tell knows his stuff, I'm just like, what do you do? Uh-huh. Yeah, you tell me, you know, right? And then when they make dumb mistakes, I punish them ruthlessly for them.
But let's say you got, you know, two players that are kind of chasing the same spotlight. Uh-huh. How do you kind of make sure the underdog has a shot at it?
Sometimes it's a good idea to make sure they've got slightly different spotlights, even if they're interested in the same thing. Like, see if you can encourage one, if they both want to be combat gods, see if you can encourage one to be like the damage output two-hander, just powering through DR kind, whereas the other is more of the two-weapon fighting, 1,000 tacks around, and then that gives you the opportunity of, like, the guy who two hands every, or makes giant two-handed blows, if he's got a dozen goblins around him, he can only hit one per round. The guy who can get 1,000 attacks around can just pick them all off, whereas if you're up against a stone golem, the guy who can two-hand it can actually make a dent in it, whereas no matter how many times the little guy pecks away with two short swords, he's not going to be doing much.
And from an organized play perspective, you might not even have that control of which characters show up. So if you have two people who are both like, every combat I just start by casting haste and then I hide. Okay, well, you know, two hastes does not really accomplish anything. So that might be something where you can use either out of character or even some NPCs to develop like a very friendly rivalry between the two, or, you know, encourage taking turns. Like, you must have other things to do other than cast haste, so how about you get to be the haste maven this time and you get to understand that you have other class abilities.
I think a lot of it can come down to how you describe it and how you narrate it, right? I mean, you know, when you got two characters both vying to be the combat god at the fight, right? You know, I think very frequently how you describe how they hit them and how they deal their damage is almost cooler and more interesting than just like, okay, and then it falls down dead. Congrats, you did the most, you know? I mean, I don't think anybody, I mean, I know internally in their heads they're kind of keeping score, but your narrative will give them, kind of, if you describe them doing cool things, it doesn't matter that the monster didn't die, right? Mm-hmm. You know, if the guy scores a good hit and does some good damage, and you're like, yeah, you drag both your blades across his torso, causing his guts to spill out, and he's holding them in with one hand as he continues to fight you. Well, that sounds cool. That's badass. But you didn't kill him. And he's still fighting you, so, meh,
and, right? And if you have bystanders, you can use those as sort of a window into how cool the underdog is. So it can be like, oh yeah, Bruiser McGee sure did do 57 points of damage, and then secondary Bruiser sure did walk up and do 23, but he did it with more style somehow. And all the NPCs are like, oh wow! Bruiser number two, you're so cool. And Bruiser number one is like, what do I need to do? What do I need to do to earn your respect?
It's how
like,
about a little style?
Right? I know.
Yeah, like Bruiser number one walks up and does 50 points of damage. Bruiser number two only does like 3 points of damage, but it's just like this gash across the villain's face and he's just, you!
Or misses, accidentally throws his greatsword and drops a chandelier that does 1 point of slashing damage because it hits one of the goblins. And everybody's like, oh man, did you intend to do that? It's like, absolutely. So, yeah, you can give each one of them their own validation.
Oh, yes.
On the topic of describing combat, I find that I say the same things over and over again, mm-hmm. and have to sort of walk the line between, oh, you know, it's a minor cut that doesn't look like it's doing anything, versus you chop the guy's arm off, but I can't mechanically reflect that he now only has one arm or is being used to hold it in his intestines.
I personally always like, when I'm trying to describe how wounds are happening, I start with weapon, impact, location, effect, right? So, and mind you, none of this has to have any game effect. But the way you describe how someone gets wounded, like, oh, your arrow sinks deep into his shoulder and is sitting there, and now every time he swings, the feathers are dodging back and forth, makes for a funny kind of visual as this guy's beaming on you and the arrow's hitting him in the face. But it doesn't have to have a rule effect, right? And the same goes for the PCs on their side of things. It's like, oh yeah, that wolf comes up and grabs your calf and just rips a huge meaty chunk out of it while it's trying to rip you to the floor, right? There's blood pouring down your leg. No, you don't have the bleed condition. That's different. That's a gusher. The bleed condition is like Monty Python style, like. But yeah, I mean, you can describe wounds and damage in a very colorful and active and very often gruesome way, without necessarily having to assign a game effect to it.
Yeah, I mean, overall, even writing combat scenes is hard in making them not sound repetitive. There are a bunch of creative writing blogs out there that go into this if you want some suggestions for how to describe the hits or how to describe people maneuvering or what kind of injuries might happen. I mean, the internet is this amazing resource for GMs if you can figure out where to look.
And just as interesting as the hits, I find the misses are also fun to describe. Just running the delve, the number of times where people started like shooting out electronics in the wall because they kept on rolling ones. That's good fun because they're like, I should have blown out all the light fixtures in here because I can't hit a goblin to save my life. But hey, at least I accomplished something. You got that.
We won't be able to restart the engines before the ship crashes into the planet because you shot up the control panels, but good job!
It's called hacking.
Yeah, that's right.
Another question? Yeah.
Holy.
So, GM's favorite topic, character death.
They deserved it.
Often.
Yeah, pretty much.
Of course. So difficult to deal with in home games, especially in situations where maybe they aren't quite at the high enough levels yet for them to be able to gain resources, but especially society, where
even the most munchkiniest of just power gamers is horrifyingly attached to this character. I know I, as a GM, feel bad killing characters unless they do something absurdly stupid to deserve it. Yeah.
That's your human compassion talking? It will not serve you well as a GM.
You need to kill that. But it also leads to a very adversarial environment, yeah. Which especially in PFS is like the death of a player.
Yeah.
How do we work?
There has to be risk in the game.
Mm-hmm.
There are going to be the rogue critical hits, sometimes with a heavy pick. And, you know, yep, that was my first kill in PFS. And
sights.
Yeah, pretty much. So that needs to be there. And, you know, it varies by scenario, but, like, scenarios are not specifically designed to be, oh, hey, this will be a death trap. Unless we tell you ahead in a bit of box text.
Yeah.
So, you know, death is going to happen, and it's partly just a matter of, as a person, as a human being at the table, being respectful of that person's experience for that 4 to 5 hour slot in how you go forward with it. Like, okay, you sure did get killed in the first encounter, but hey, we're in Absalom. We can take sort of a little break from this to see about finding somebody to bring you back. We're out in the wilderness, but look, it's not a time-sensitive adventure. Don't worry. Hang on, we still have one encounter before the PCs can escape, and we'll get things rolling again. So hang in with us. Yeah, just don't be a dick.
I think a big part of it comes down to you need to, as GM, always give off the I am the impartial rules adjudicator, right? And sometimes that means the rules are going to kill you. And if your players never feel like you're doing it with malice or spite, they are going to come to their death. They're not going to be happy. They're going to come to their death with an understanding that it wasn't you who killed them. It was the dice and the scenario and the encounter and bad luck. And that allows you also the freedom to be like, oh man, I'm sorry, but I think you're dead, right? You know, and give them condolences on the spot. That's like, hey, no, I think you just bit it. I think that pig just went into your frontal lobe. You're done.
You're just like, shit, man, that sucks. That Jason Bowman's a murderer.
I'm going to go write another 1-star review on scenarios for John Constantine. <to read. laughs>
and to be honest, you can always just blame me. Right, I mean, it is my fault. So,
I think we got time enough for maybe two more.
We're the last panel for the day, so we don't have to clear out until the actual end of the hour.
It don't matter.
So, in regards to things that players have done that at first just looked, you know, you thought, well, I don't think that's going to work, but ended up either was there anything players that did that turned out to be just amazing to you? Whether advancing the story or plot or like, okay, give it a try. Wow, that actually worked.
Yep.
Yes. Hey, you want to start?
Yes, please.
All right.
Okay, so playing an evil campaign.
Oh, boy.
It was the evil campaign published by... Way of the Wicked. Thank you. Sorry, it's been a very long weekend. And at the... spoiler alert right off the bat. At the end of the first adventure, your assignment is to infiltrate this paladin citadel that's basically on the Winter Wall and destroy it so that evil humanoid forces can pour through and start a war. And... you know, the game is basically built assuming your PCs have built like evil fighter, evil wizard, evil cleric, and evil rogue, and are going to dungeon crawl through the citadel. Except my players made evil bard.
Good.
Evil ranger who had no combat skills. Evil cleric with a charisma way higher than her wisdom, and. I can't even remember what the fifth was now. Oh, a necromancer who had no attack spells.
So So they were bad at being bad.
No, they were great at being bad because they decided, well, every castle like this needs a town that supports it, and like that's where they make all the food, that's where they make supplies, and the adventure includes the town and like a brief write up of it and things like that. So like, all right, well, we're gonna infiltrate the town, we're gonna stay at the tavern, we're gonna pose as like, I'm a merchant and this is my beautiful wife and here's my manservant and our idiot child, and we stay at the inn. We were mugged on the road in, and that's why we don't have any of our wares. And they spent the next 3 weeks basically subtly manipulating everyone in town into fighting with each other and using infernal healing to make townsfolk detect as evil to the paladins.
Oh, that's nice.
So eventually they got the fort commander to strike. They convinced a woman whose husband had been locked up because of their machinations that it was all the fort commander's fault, and got her to like go charging at him screaming to bawl him out basically, but they cast infernal healing on her just before they'd sent her out. And the paladin sees this woman charging at him, detects that she is supernaturally evil, and in the midst of like the rest of the town imploding and everything going crazy, he strikes her down and loses his paladin class features. And then they just roll over the citadel and the like 12 people left in it.
For mine, in a home game that I was running, one of my players, because we were like in high school at that point, was, you know, there's always the oddball person. And he was the one who would do stupid things just to piss off my friend Kyle. And so he decided that he was going to take the Elemental Master Prestige class, which required, as a prerequisite, you need to have peaceful contact with an elemental creature of the element that you're going to do, which he wanted fire. So I threw like some sort of like fire elemental thing into this pyramid that had a glowing orb at the top of it, which was just like, oh, sun pyramid moment. And so the fire elemental is like, you guys are really cool. In fact, I think you're so cool, I'm going to give you guys a wish. And so Kyle, who is a very, like, he want, like, this is the sort of moment where he's like, oh my gosh, all my D&D training, it's paying off, and like starts to scribble down the exact placement of commas and things. And my friend, also named John at that point, the kind of wacky one, is just like, well, kind of formulating things. He's like, I wish for whatever that glowing thing is on top of the pyramid. And the element is like, done! And Kyle's just like, ah, what have you done? What have you done? And he's like, bah! And a little copper orb is in this gnome's hand. He's like, okay, so what does it do? Well, here's the command word. Okay, say the command word. It glows with light. Cool, I say it again. It turns off. Awesome!
I got a glowing orb.
And so Kyle is like dying and pacing in rage. He's like, oh, what have you done? It was a wish. This is the very foundation of tabletop role-playing games, you fool. And off of that, I was just like, okay, well, I mean, John seems to be pretty attached to this thing. So, you know what? I'm going to develop a system where he can gradually, as he does more fire elementally things, unlock more powers in it. And eventually I made one of these items for every one of the players, and it became one of the touchstones of that campaign. But it was just one of those moments of, what have you done? Oh, what we've done is we've made a subsystem. So, yeah, dumb things can make cool stuff.
I'm always amazed by
what the hell did Mona do?
It was a pit.
I'm always amazed by players that get so into the story and get so deep into the narrative that they reach that point where they realize they're telling a character's story, and they get to the point where they realize that they may have just reached the end of that character's story. And, you know, they're fighting against some demon or something, and they realize things have now turned against them, and they're all about to be murdered. And they, you know, I love that moment when you can see it on their face, and they go, you know what? Run, guys. I'll hold it off. And they know their story is done. They know that they have just said, I'm going to die. Go. And that's always kind of the best. So, anyway.
to break that tone for a moment, Kyle, ladies and gentlemen. I told them about the glowing orb that John wished for.
I think that's actually about it. Yeah, we're at time. So thank you very much for coming, everybody. Hope you guys had a great PaizoCon.
Not have PaizoCon every year without all of you buying our lovely products.
Yeah. Thank you for buying our stuff, which prevents us from having to go get a real job.
Thank you for joining us for another edition of the No Direction Podcast PaizoCon 2017 seminar coverage, made possible with the help of Justin Sluder and Ryan Hiller of Geek Dad. To find more great Pathfinder audio, go to NoDirectionPodcast.com.